All right, I think we're going. Well, I don't want to go over like too much of the obvious of what's happening these days, but just sort of carry on to maybe some things we've already talked about and carry it to now, if that's possible. I'd like to tell everybody welcome to the Infinitesimal Dialectic with my first guest, Derek Jensen, who hopefully will help us bring this some sort of fruition. I will start with Derek. Just give a brief outline to the work you do and what you're doing these days.
I'm a writer and grassroots environmental activist. I got 25, 26 books out, mainly about stopping this culture from murdering the planet. And I also do work on stopping men's violence against women. Those are the two main issues I work on.
Oh, great. So I wonder how in some ways maybe like trying not to push this dialogue too many places. I just like to kind of let it grow for wherever it is. But I find it fascinating that we're living in a time right now where this sort of reset button, I guess you could put in some terms, has kind of come upon us. I don't know what your thoughts on that.
Are you talking about like the current pandemic?
Yes, sir.
The thing with the pandemic is that I've been a little bit surprised that this hasn't happened many times already, much more severely, because the conditions for it are, I mean, you couldn't really ask for better conditions from a virus or from some sort of pathogen perspective. Actually the first thing I wrote for a major magazine, for a huge magazine, was the New York Times Magazine in 96 or so, was a very brief little article about collapse that was happening of honeybee populations at the time. And this is a different than colony collapse disorder, which happened later.
Okay.
This one was, I don't remember if it was varroa or tracheal mites, but it was a type of mite and just swept the country really quickly. And I pointed out that the conditions that people had created or the economic system had created made this inevitable. That, first off, every January in Modesto County, there are, I don't know, a half million, million, some huge number of honeybee colonies are brought together to pollinate almonds, or as I say locally, almonds. And putting that many colonies in one place is a recipe to have a transmissible disease transmitted between the hives. And then the bees would be moved from there to oranges, prunes, whatever, and then eventually it would go to their summer places, which might be as far away as North Dakota. Meanwhile, other beekeepers in North Dakota spend their summers in North Dakota and they spend their winters in Florida on the oranges. And so the point is you can have a mite go from Modesto to North Dakota, be transferred to a different hive, and then go to Florida. So you can cover the entire country in 1 year. And that is So when you combine high population density with high mobility, this is the dream of every pathogen. And that's exactly what we've got. We've got people packed tight in cities, and then we have the capacity to, and just instead of thinking of them as people for a moment, just as we, could think of the bees for a moment as not honeybees, but instead as carriers for the pathogen, as
Pollinators, you know.
as well, well what I was going to say is as if we perceive this from a pathogen's perspective,
Okay.
it's like, wow, I've got a whole bunch of hosts here packed in one place. And then they're going to be moved across the world. This is just a dream. This is like going into, I don't know, a candy store. And then at the edge of the candy store, there's an escalator that takes you to another candy store. And, so I'm just, and you know, cities have been cities have been sinks, population sinks up until modern hygiene. That the average lifespan of somebody who moved to London from the country about a couple hundred years ago was about 18 months, because of sicknesses associated with people being packed in that tight, and plus all the toxins and everything. But anyway, so I'm just surprised that this has not happened to us sooner and more often. And I think that this will certainly not be the last. And it's not even that, and this is not to take anything away from the people who have died from it, but this is so far not, there are pandemics that have happened like the Black Death that were way, way, way more severe. And at some point, one of those is going to pop up.
You touched on a little bit in there about the environmental situation, which I have found to be true as well, as far as pollutants and the possibility of different pollutants that could be maybe playing a part in this.
You know, I'm not enough of an epidemiologist to be able to say with this specific situation. What I can say very comfortably is that it's a really bad idea to blanket the planet in carcinogens, nerve agents, mutagens, endocrine disruptors. It's just a really bad idea.
Yeah.
And so I think it gets really difficult to, like, you know, I have Crohn's disease, and it gets really difficult to attempt to assign one specific cause to one specific illness. And those, you know, I've seen corporations hem and haw in the same way I'm hemming and hawing right now, for different reasons, I think, that, you know, they will say, you know, there can be a cancer cluster in a certain town, and they will say, yeah, go ahead, prove that cancer cluster came from the chemicals that we are making right here. And everybody knows that chemical cluster is from those local chemicals, but you can't, the cancer cluster is from the chemicals they're releasing. But it becomes very hard to prove that this specific chemical causes specific cancer.
Right, right.
I mean, it ends up being like in the American Civil War when you have, you know, 1,000 people or 10,000 people on each side shooting each other, which bullet actually shot the guy? Like, was it yours? Was it yours? Was it yours? I mean, he's still dead, and there was still lots of lead flying through the air. We just don't know which bullet it was.
Right. Right. And that can go to a lot of things these days of what you're saying, things that are flying around at us or different things that are compromising our systems. You can't really prove, say, that it's one specific thing.
Yeah, it becomes very difficult. There are some cases where it can be done. I lived in North Idaho for a while, and there had been prior to that, There was a town called Smelterville, still is, and
like a smelter in metal, you mean?
Yeah. I believe it's called the Silver Valley. Anyway, yeah. The bag house on the smelter burned, and the bag house was a pollution control device, and the company had a choice: either A, we shut down the whole operation until we fix the bag house, or B, we go ahead and continue operation and then handle lawsuits when they come in. And
The numbers game.
And numbers game. And they chose, and you can see the handwritten notes by one of the officers at the board meeting saying $500,000 per kid. And that how much they figured it would cost. And the children in the community ended up with some of the highest blood lead levels ever known among humans. And it worked out exactly as I said, that they just paid off the lawsuits and continued to operate. In that case, it was really pretty easy to determine that the lead had come from the smelter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's often not that easy.
No, it's not. I know from my traveling around as a child with my mother, we ended up in the area near Simi Valley when that little accident happened, and I had some benign tumors. And I saw a class action suit years later about it, and it was actually $30,000 per family. And by my calculations, most of those people weren't even around anymore anyways. So it seems like the numbers game seems to work pretty well.
Well, and that's what they've been banking on the whole time. Meanwhile, the entire world is killed.
Absolutely. You know, I've been self-quarantined myself in this, and I've tried to have some incidents in my own life where I've kind of gone really inward in the last year, and everything's been more amplified, obviously, because of this time we're in, but I've also just been kind of listening to some of us who have been seeing this for quite some time, and now that the freight train's crashed, I'm really curious, if we want to put it in those terms, in how some of us who have been anticipating, if you want to put it in that way, what's next, so to speak. Like, reading Arundhati Roy was kind of nice in the sense of the pandemic as a portal idea of, this is a strange opportunity to really shift, maybe changing in some ways. And I wonder how possible you think that is, or if that's, like some of my friends say, that'll never happen. But what do you think of that kind of idea?
I unfortunately don't think that. I think that the addiction to this way of life and the addiction to the comforts or elegancies this way of life produces, the addiction to the power that is gained by this way of life, and the addiction to the hatred of the natural world is stronger than most people's attraction to life. And I believe that there are significant numbers of those who will attempt to maintain this way of life until there is absolutely no choice, by which I really mean the planet's dead. I see that we have had many, many opportunities over the past several thousand years to do the right thing. And there will be individuals who do the right thing, but I think that, and by the way, I want to say that when I say I don't think they'll do the right thing, that does not mean that we should sit on our hands or we should give up.
I do hear you on that. It's just a test of imagination. I'm in agreement with you. I don't see this, you call it addiction. I'm with you on that. But I also see it as sort of domesticated situation where we don't even have sort of the built-in intuitive will to kind of to do what's necessary, the right thing, if you want to put it in those terms. So I'm definitely on the same page. I just wonder... It's like you said, continue with sitting on your hands. One of my friends asked me, like, do you feel like you're having an effect talk? And I'm like, well, probably in reality, no, but it doesn't stop me.
And I have a few responses to that. One of them is that, years ago, I did a talk for a really good organization called the Buckeye Forest Council. And it's a forest protection group in Ohio. And after the talk, I was talking with one of the people who is central to the organization.
Excuse me.
And he told me about an exchange he'd had with a Forest Service supervisor. That the Forest Service supervisor kept trying to clear cut part of the National Forest, and they kept stopping him. And the supervisor finally said, look, we have lots of money. We get paid to do this. You're not getting paid on your side. So we're going to keep putting out this timber sale. You can keep stopping us for a while, but eventually we're going to get it through and the forest will be cut. And so why are you bothering? And the guy said, well, you may in fact cut it in the future. I don't know. But the worst case scenario is that we have made it so there will be several generations of butterflies, of salamanders, of everybody who lives in this forest who doesn't know you exist and who live out their lives. And both he, the guy saying it, and I recognize that that's not sufficient to just protect the forest for a couple more generations until they're exterminated. But that's still something, and that is still good enough reason to do it. And but that's not enough, obviously. And the next part is that, you know, my friend John Osborne, who was the one who got me started in environmentalism 30 years ago, says that when he's asked why he does the work he does, he always says, as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is, if bull trout are around in 10 years, they might be around in 100. But if they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. And so there's this not on my watch attitude I think that we all need to take too, to find. Yesterday, somebody got really mad at me because she said I wasn't providing a checklist of things for people to do. And I said, great, here's your checklist. 1, find some place you love. 2, defend it. Let me know when you've done that. And then you get really pissed. But the point is that's...
Because it wasn't enough, or I'm curious, or just because it was too simple?
No, she was mad because it involved defending the natural world and she wanted to know consumer choices she could make.
Ah, I see. Okay.
She was all mad because I wouldn't tell her that if you buy LED light bulbs, that everything's going to be okay. Anyway, so right. That's another thing. And then another thing is that we just have to do our work and put our contribution into the stew and hope that it tastes good. And one can never know. You know, one of the reasons that I write the books I do is because I was in the Spokane Public Library sometime in the 80s, and Neil Everndon's book, The Natural Alien, jumped off the shelf at me. And it was the first book I'd read that didn't take this human-centric perspective on the world as a given. And it was the first book I read that didn't make the distinction between meaningful humans and non-meaningful everything else. And later I asked Neil Everndon, so if we don't make the distinction between meaningful humans and non-meaningful non-humans, where do we make the distinction? And his answer was perfect, which was, why do you have to make the distinction at all? I mean, everybody has a life that is as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And my point is that in some ways, all of my work is a response to being in the library that day and Neil Everndon's book jumping off the shelf. And had Neil Everndon not written that book, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have written mine. And then because I've written my books, other people have done their work. And so, well, one person by him or herself cannot stop this juggernaut of destruction. we also can't predict the effects of our actions. And that I've been in communication with Jeff Gibbs, who just put out the wonderful movie Planet of the Humans. And in part of our exchange, one of the things he said to me, and I'm not in any way taking credit for his great film, but he said that my work was one of the things that inspired him to do this. So it's like, you can't, you don't know who is listening to this. And there could be a 17-year-old who is listening to this, that this could, who's listening to your work, who could then dramatically change her life because of this, and then she goes on to accomplish something that influences somebody else, that influences somebody else, and then that person ends up, you know, protecting the Columbia River by helping to take out the dam. So we don't know. You know, we can't see where that reaches out. We can certainly be smart and try to aim stuff so that, you know, obviously Neil Everndon's book aimed me in a specific direction, and had he written the book differently, it might not have done anything. The point is it's not purely random what happens in somebody's response to your work or my work or anybody's work. And I know this is a complete cliche, but it's always stuck with me from the locker room wall when I was in college. There was a slogan on it, which was, luck is where preparation meets opportunity. And I've experienced that so many times in my life. You know, a great example is the thing I mentioned before. The New York Times Magazine was the first major magazine thing first thing I had published in a major magazine, a huge magazine. And the editor that I was working with there loved my work. And he kept trying to get me to make different pitches to the magazine. And the thing is, I was not prepared. I didn't yet know how to write a good pitch. I had written one good article, but I wasn't a good enough writer to be able to take advantage of the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so in consequence, I pretty much blew that opportunity, because I gave him one good piece, and then everything after that was not good enough. And I'm not blaming him. It literally wasn't good enough, because it would have been like an 18-year-old going into the major leagues, happening to hit a home run on his first at bat. And then after that, he comes back to reality and strikes out, you know, the next 17 times in a row. I just wasn't ready.
Right, right.
And so that was a case of, I did not get lucky, because the opportunity was there, but the preparation had not come. Which has huge implications for social change too. That I was really excited a few years ago when Arab Spring was taking place, and I actually wrote some stuff about how, oh, this is going to change everything. And I was talking to a friend at the time who said, you need to realize there's a difference between mobilization and organization. That yeah. Facebook, for example, can mobilize 20,000 people. Great. You can get them together. But the pro-democracy forces in Egypt were not the winners of Arab Spring. The first round winners were the Muslim Brotherhood. Why? Because they'd been organizing since 1920 or something. Right. And they were ready to take advantage of the opportunity. Second round winners were the Western-backed dictatorship that then crushed the Muslim Brotherhood, because they had even more money and they'd been organizing even longer. Mm. So the point is, you organize, organize, organize. You do everything you can. Oh, another way to say all this is that Joseph Campbell spent his 20s writing a bunch of crap. And the reason he did that is because he spent his 20s learning how to write, so that when he was in his 30s and he had something to say, he would know how to write. And there's nothing bad against Joseph Campbell. I was writing crap in my 20s too. Every writer who writes anything good in their 30s.
I can relate as a musician, all the crap I did up until I was 30. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Out again.
yeah, it's just, except at the time, it's like, oh, listen, this is the best song ever. And then you listen to it 10 years later, it's like, holy crap, that was terrible.
What was I thinking? Yes. No,
it's called practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the same thing has to happen on a large scale. So many people have come to me and said, you know, I tried to do this work to save this forest and we got stomped on, so now I'm discouraged. It's like, yeah, I understand that you get discouraged, but you have to practice. You have to learn how to do it. And you're going to lose a lot of times, but thing is, you dust yourself off, get up and do it again. It's no different than the first time you picked up a basketball. Did you make a basket? No. You know, it's the first time. I mean, there's a lot of practice and a lot of failure, and that's true of everything we do, including right. activism.
No, I agree. And like one of the things I learned growing up too is if you want to get better at things, this is what you do, like playing pool. You play with better players, so that you learn from good things. And I've always done the same thing with music and even such as your writings. When I first read them, they were like great lyrical content. And like, you know, and it was kind of a jump for me of like, there's so much writing out there that I could put into a more of a folk story that works on the levels you're talking about. And there's different forms. And I see this sort of weird zeitgeist happening right now where a lot of the things that worked before aren't working now, meaning system breakdown and the stuff we've been talking about. We're really hitting it. This, I think in some ways, even the pandemic, it's terrible. It's terrible what's happening to people, but I really don't think this is going to be even as big as the next things to come.
I agree with you.
And maybe we could explore that a little. I don't know.
Well, okay. Sorry. When you said maybe we could explore that a little, I rolled my eyes and I want to know that I was not rolling my eyes at you. I was rolling my eyes at the difficulty of, I'm really bad at prognostication.
Okay. And
we can try, but I mean, I was watching basketball tournaments. I mean, what was it? Early March. So it's less than 2 months ago. I was watching. What was it? It was, The conference that Gonzaga's in, was that Western Athletic Conference, I think?
You would know more than me, probably.
I don't know which conference it is, sorry. Whatever conference they're in. I was watching their tournament when all of a sudden the NCAA said, hey, we're canceling the tournament, we're canceling March Madness later on. It's like, and my point is, I didn't predict that.
Right.
I'd been watching this particular epidemic since so I have a friend, the doctor friend, John Osborne, the environmentalist doctor friend. Uh-huh. He'd been watching it since early December. And he has an interest in pandemics. He noticed AIDS, in 1981 and,
grids.
What?
When it was grids, 81. I don't even think they called it AIDS at that point.
Yeah. He said that he was, I mean, for just what he does, or one of the things he does is read journals of pathology and journals of, and he noticed a pattern. He's not the first person, obviously, but he noticed a pattern of young gay men dying who shouldn't be dying. Okay. And the point is that he recognized that pattern. He was already a doctor or finishing his internship or whatever it's called, and residency. And, then he went and became a Doctors Without Borders, went over to, AIDS clinic in, Thailand. And I mean, so he cares deeply about epidemics and pandemics and saving people from them. He said he caught this in early December. He was very worried already. Yeah. I didn't notice it until a little bit later. But the point is, I was following it and I still didn't think they were going to call off the baseball season and shut down everything. And I want to say one more thing about it that I think the moment it really caught my attention was 2 days after they shut down Wuhan, a Hyundai factory in South Korea shut down. Mm-hmm. And the reason the Hyundai factory shut down is Do you know about just-in-time method of inventory?
Mm-mm.
Okay, it's really stupid, and it's what they've gone to.
Okay.
It could be that if you have a factory, this applies to the whole natural world, applies to everything we're talking about, really. If you okay. have a factory, I recognize factories are inherently destructive of the planet. I mean, that's a given with me, so we don't need to go there.
Yeah, we're both there. Okay.
Yeah. So if you have a factory, up until the 70s and 80s and 90s, you would normally keep, say, a month's worth of parts on hand, a month's worth of right. inventory that you're going to use to assemble your car, lawnmower, whatever you're going to assemble.
So you have a continuing work for base for so much time.
Yeah. And then, you know, when it's down to 2 weeks worth, then you order another month's worth, whatever. But then what they found with instantaneous communication with computers and computerized inventory and also global transportation, instantaneous transportation, that was wasting money to keep all that inventory there. So what they did is they started using just in time, which is there's only 1 or 2 days worth of parts at the factory and you have them delivered every day.
Oh, I see. All right.
Because you don't have all that money tied up in stuff sitting in your warehouse. That's great for them as long as nothing happens. But it's really, 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 really stupid when you recognize that these transportation systems can be interdicted by weather, by pandemic. So basically, that Hyundai plant in South Korea had 2 days after Wuhan shut down, they had to shut down because they had no parts. And that's a huge weakness on the system. And the way that applies to the larger scale is that it's really, really stupid to not have local food supplies. It's really, really stupid to get your...
Seems like a no-brainer to me.
It is a no-brainer, but that doesn't alter the fact that I was just looking up a couple days ago, for reasons having nothing to do with this, just because this is what I do. I was looking up Danish imports from China and India. And they import a lot of food from, not a lot, I mean they do grow some local food, but they import significant amounts of food from China and India. And that's crazy. That is just crazy and, you know, we can.
Especially when a country like India has so many hungry people.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that makes it even crazier. Absolutely. You know, my mom went to, Africa back in the 90s. And the thing that appalled her the most was seeing these huge lima bean fields and huge fields of cash crops to be sent to Europe. And so the local people have been driven off their land, so that a transnational corporation can export Brussels sprouts to Brussels. Mm. And that's morally obscene. And it's also just crazy. It's also what the entire global system is based on.
Mm-hmm.
And here is something I think that is achievable out of. This doesn't really help the natural world all that much, but this is something that a change I think might take place because of this pandemic. We'll see. And if they can't even do this, then there's no hope for anything. I think this may cause some level of relocalization.
Yeah. There's a lot of balkanizing going on though in that thought process I've noticed in what you're talking about that. You know, it seems getting localized, but everybody's worried about their thing. Seems like I don't want to generalize, but I do find a lot of that.
So I'm going to say something that's going to make even more people on the left hate me.
Okay.
I'm just asking a question though. So before we're saying this, I'm not saying anything. I'm asking a damn question. Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at everybody who's going to get mad at me over this. I'm preemptively mad.
I can handle it.
And what's the word? Yeah, it's like preemptive strikes with the nuclear. That's the one they were concerned. I'm doing a preemptive anger strike. So, So as long as you're not killing each other, what is wrong? What is wrong with a certain level of balkanization?
Right. Okay.
No. This is a real question. I'm not saying I agree with the position. I'm not saying I disagree. This is a real question for you.
Sure.
What is wrong with a certain level?
Probably nothing in what you're saying. I mean, I listen to some even people's reasonings and they're very viable. You know, you have a family to think about. You might have, I mean, there are many different facets, but it seems to me to me in this specific situation, and I'm sure people get upset with me on the same level as you, that if we can all get together and fight this, then why can't we do it in other ways?
Well, that's really true. And Michael Moore just said that a couple of days ago. It's like he said, you know, we've shown this whole pandemic has shown that people will accept significant changes in their life for an emergency. And why can't we do that for global warming, for example?
Right.
And, you know, my mom lived through that in World War II.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I hear what you're saying, and there is that concern about balkanization, especially when we talk about the Balkans, because at this point, Balkans makes us think of what happened in the Balkans through the 90s and 80s. It was, you know, after the death of Tito, it was a nightmare for a lot of people.
Yes.
It's, you know, I did an interview. The left got really mad at me. Some guy, you know, I say yes to most interviews, and a guy wanted to interview me, and he's a white nationalist, and I don't think I knew this going into the interview, and then we did the interview. He sent me some questions, and his questions were actually great. The questions themselves were much better than the questions I got from the left after I did that interview, and the questions from the left were, why are you such a fascist? Like, he asked questions, I answered them. And one of his questions had to do with, basically, as global warming continues, what do I think is going to happen with refugee movements? And will there be, will there be increased hostility toward refugees? Basically, I don't know if that was his question, but it was something along those lines.
That's a great question.
It is really good. It's a desperately important question.
It really is.
And I don't care who's asking it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer was, okay, we have to recognize when we talk about refugees at this point, really, or when we talk about immigrants in general.
Right.
First thing we have to acknowledge is that most people don't leave their communities and move across the world for the fun of it. That most of the people who move, it's often because their communities have been destroyed. And a lot of that, a lot of the responsibility for the destruction of those communities lies at the center of empire. Like when somebody from Guatemala comes to the United States, they're not coming for an eco-tour of the San Joaquin Valley. They're coming because their land has been taken for a banana plantation, or their land has been taken for coffee, for whatever.
Right.
And so I'm not blaming them at all. I'm just saying that that much of that movement is because of the action of capitalists.
Right.
Okay. So that part pissed off the right wingers. And then the next part pissed off the left wingers because they said, that said, you can't blame someone who lives in a community somewhere in the center of empire. You can't really blame them when, through no specific fault of their own, there is an influx of people from the outside who are changing their community, perhaps in ways they don't like. And that pissed off the left. And I just think that I don't think it's helpful for everybody to just get pissed off at that. I think it's helpful to look at the cause and effect and look at why the one person, why exploitation caused the one person to move, and then why the other person whose life is also being affected may feel some resentment when their community has changed. And that the first thing, it's like my doctor friend says, proper diagnosis is the first, or correct diagnosis is the first step toward treatment. If we don't talk about it, we can't resolve those differences. We can't figure out how to deal with them. And this is so true. You know, we see this with the response to, I mean, this seems to be, the left has a special problem with this these days, but it happens all over the place, that there is this problem of, you know, the big green organizations are really mad at the Jeff Gibbs, Michael Moore, Ozzie Zehner film, and so they're calling for it to be withdrawn, and they're calling for...
Right, they're actually asking for censorship on...
Yeah,
and it's like, about that. I found that interesting.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I've always been really motivated by, okay, decades ago, Jerry Mander wrote a very good and interesting book called In the Absence of the Sacred. And then Ward Churchill wrote an essay attacking Jerry Mander's book. And I asked Jeanette Armstrong what she thought about Ward Churchill's essay. And her answer has guided me ever since, which is, if Ward didn't like the book, he should write his own damn book. Hmm. So if somebody doesn't like the Jeff Gibbs, Michael Moore, Ozzie Zehner film, well, you know what? Make your own damn film.
Right.
And make it better. And make it more convincing. And then it's the same here, that if me saying that somebody in a community that is having people from the outside move in through no fault of their own, and they don't like how that's affecting their community, if you don't like me saying that, then you address the situation in a better way, and I will be delighted. And this is true no matter what we're talking about. If somebody thinks that your style of putting on a show is crap, well, great. Do a better
way. Right.
This is always, and this is why I write my books. That one of the reasons I wrote my books is because I noticed that there was a big hole in discourse. And instead of just whining about the fact that there's a big hole in discourse, it's like, fill it. I'll just write it. And the good news about that's
a really great point. I mean, when I was first coming up as a musician, I remember I was whining about the crap that's out there, and then finally someone said to me, you don't like it, Hawk, make something better.
Exactly. And the good news is that if there is nothing but crap out there and you can see that there is a place where nobody is doing good music, you don't actually have to do backflips in order to do good music. You just have to be yourself. I mean, that's the thing I found with my writing is that I just have to tell the truth as I understand it to be. And because nobody else is doing that particular thing, it's like, my God, it's like when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, my main method of teaching students writing, and this would only work for writing, would have been harder for chemistry or something where you're actually teaching a subject.
Okay.
My main method of teaching them how to write was I believe that the way you learn how to write is by writing more. And okay. So my job was to make it so writing was fun enough that they would do it on their own and they would get better just by practice. And so basically all I did to them was say, wow, that was a really good essay you wrote. Can you write another one? And, but I had to mean it. You know, like you can't fake it. So I had to mean it, but that was all I did. And these students who had basically had just every paper they ever wrote had a flood of red ink all over it.
Oh, that was my paper.
What?
That was my paper.
Well, it was everybody's paper. And that's what I hated writing. And they would write this paper for me and then I would turn it back with, wow, the first paragraph's great. The third paragraph's great. Can you make the second paragraph as good as your first and third one? Because the second paragraph wasn't very good. But instead of going, second paragraph stinks, I would just say, wow, great, great. Make this one as good too. And the point is, I would just laugh because if any of them had ever had someone who simply accepted them for who they were and encouraged them to write, I would have had to get a real job. It was the biggest con of all because for 10 years, I was a very successful writing teacher by basically just saying, hey, good job, write another one, write 10 more pages. And that was so funny because my students would complain at the end of the class, they would complain that the class had been too easy. But here's the thing, the typical student in my 12-week quarter, 10-week quarter, however long it was, would write probably 20 to 30 essays, and all the other sections, they had to write like 3 essays total. So I'm literally having them write 6 times as much than any other group. They're complaining it's too easy, and the reason is because I let them write whatever they wanted and told them it was great.
Well, that lends to the idea of discovery. I mean, discovering one's own work is kind of important in learning, maybe?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. And somebody's asked me one time, this was a good question. It took me a while to figure out. Somebody asked me one time, why when I had students like that, I was always so positive, but at the same time, I am so harsh in my criticism of the culture. Why don't I go to the culture and say, hey, you're doing this good and this good. Why can't you do the other good? And it took me a little while to figure it out, but it all has to do with power. And if I'm a teacher, I have power over my students.
Okay.
And it's my responsibility to only use that power to basically make them feel better. And on the other hand, if I see someone who has power over somebody and they're misusing it, it's my responsibility to stop them using whatever means are necessary.
Okay. I see.
We've gone far afield.
What's that?
We've gone far afield.
Yeah. Yeah, we have. And it's just from some of the stuff you're speaking about, maybe kind of leads into a little bit of how I feel about media and how it plays a role in some of this workings. To me, the reason I do these videos and music or whatnot is because I really actually feel like we're 5-year-olds messing around with media and we don't even really know the power it has over us in some strange way, like the suspension of disbelief, the idea that that can happen to you and you can leave all these little thoughts outside of yourself and there's this thing that creeps in and you don't think it's a part of your milieu, but it is on some level.
Completely agree. A couple things. One of them is, so last night, okay, this is like the most embarrassing thing I've admitted in an interview for a long time. So last night, I don't even like action movies.
Okay.
So, I mean, I like movies with some action, but I don't like movies that basically have no plot and there's people just beating each other up.
Oh, like violence porn.
Yeah, basically. I don't mind violence in a movie as long as it is necessary to the plot, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
You know, all that stuff. But I like mysteries, whatever. But so I put on this stupid, terrible, action movie. I mean, it was on Netflix and I'm in for a penny, in for a pound. So I may as well say it's Extraction. Just dreadful, dreadful. No plot. The whole thing is basically Chris Hemsworth or whatever his name is, the guy who was in, Hunger Games, basically him running around killing all sorts of people. I don't know what the body count was. Okay. So the embarrassing thing is, so it's a terrible movie. You know, I'm doing other things while I'm, you know, cleaning up the house. I'm doing other things. It's just on kind of in the background. And still, I'm going to go ahead and ruin the thing because anybody will thank me because it's just so stupid. So he gets shot in the end and we think he's going to die, but we're not 100% sure if he dies, but we're pretty sure he dies. Anyway, when this character I didn't care about, in this stupid movie I didn't care about, when he gets shot and he's having his, we think, death scene, I teared up. Like,
sorry.
No, that's really powerful.
It is.
And this is, you know, I remember reading this interview, not reading, hearing an interview with some rock and roll guy. I don't remember who it was. And he said he had gone to Mongolia and played rock and roll for kids who were, who had never encountered Western music at all. Okay. And he said it was really thrilling to him to play power chords and have these teenagers respond strongly. And he was saying that as a good thing. It scared the hell out of me.
Mm.
And the reason it scared the hell out of me is because music is different than writing, in that writing has to be translated and music directly enters our bodies.
Right.
And affect us viscerally, by which I literally mean viscerally. It can change us inside, and it makes me very scared that some rock and roll player can play some notes, open up a teenager, and then insert a message of, you know, Ted Nugent, Cat Scratch Fever, you know, or just can insert whatever message they want to insert, or advertisers can do the same thing. And
no, and it's really serious.
Oh, it terrifies me. You know, Lewis Mumford is one of my heroes, and he did not like rock concerts. And when I first read him, I still liked rock concerts, and I was really kind of offended. It's like, no, they're great. And then I saw this video. And I still
shop that one. The sacred cow of concerts. I'm with you on that. It's really hard to swallow, but it's the truth.
I mean, and don't get me wrong. The thing, I love live music. I love it. And
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And I can't even think about something like, I'm literally tearing up right now just thinking about Ode to Joy, you know, Beethoven's.
Yeah.
Ode to Joy, it gets me, and I, every time. Anyway, so the moment I realized that I agreed with Mumford was I was watching a video of AC/DC playing at a concert in Rio del Plata, I think it is, a pretty famous one on the internet.
Right.
And you have, as they're playing Highway to Hell, you have 50,000 young people are all pulsing like one giant being.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that I keep coming to the image of like Sauron's Ring of Power, you know, that there are.
Well, it's a great analogy. No, it's a great metaphor. It is kind of like that, isn't it? I mean,
there is tremendous power in all media, in TV, you know. I mean, there have been stupid Hallmark commercials, not Hallmark commercials, but like, I don't know, insurance commercials or commercials for something or another that have made me cry in 20 seconds, you know. And they're selling insurance.
Oh, it's, I remember when I finally hit kind of a wall for me. I don't know if you remember this. There was this old commercial where they have these Italian women out in the orchard picking spaghetti up off the tree. And they say, our spaghetti's so good at the end that you would have thought we'd grown it on trees. And I remember thinking to myself, I actually believe that. I actually fell into there, and it really bothered me.
I completely hear what you're saying. And it's both pernicious and all enveloping. And I don't, I mean, ultimately, I don't think that there, I think, ultimately, I don't think that there can be a mass media that is helpful. Because I think that,
yeah.
But in the meantime, You know, I don't know. I've been rambling on about this, and I want to hear what you – I mean, you tell me what you think about all this stuff about media, especially having to do with music and concerts. I'm intrigued by you not necessarily disagreeing with Mumford.
Yeah. I come from a different place in about it, and for me, it's kind of like why I brought Marshall McLuhan's work to this. Once I started understanding media through that kind of lens, that it has this strange acoustical effect. It's almost, as we call, primitive. Tribal. It gets into some very deep ends of us. That once I started figuring out, I don't know how to put this, but there was a time I did larger concerts, and one day I came out and I was just goofing around, waving my hands, and the of course the proverbial audience moves with your hands back and forth, but it actually kind of really scared me.
Oh yeah, that's terrifying.
It's a terrifying thought that you can move people like that, and I knew at that time personally as an artist I wasn't very I didn't have my shit together. I felt as character and different things, and so it sent me down a different trope. And what I've really seen with the power of media and music is when it's authentic and it's more involved with people, it's actually more powerful. But that's not our normal way of looking at music these days.
I think there is...
If that makes sense to you.
There is... I don't know if there is a better way to bring a community together than to have them sing together.
Right.
Sing and to move their bodies together, to dance together too. I mean, Indigenous people have known this forever.
Right. It's a no-brainer, actually.
And for crying out loud, Hitler knew it too.
Oh yeah, very well.
Which is part of the point.
It's, right.
It's a thing that can be used for. It is not a thing. It is a part of us. It is a part of us. It is a living part of our communities that can also be toxified and turned into a community destroying.
Right. It really is. And I mean, to some degrees in what you're talking about, we're so devoid of experiencing the music together. You know, it's all these memes or all the things that are thrown at you. And it's this real person. It's my personal thing. But the actual engagement stuff you're talking about is why, as some people see it as primitive, I think it's actually how we need to be dealing with media, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. It does. And I think the way we can get away from the word primitive is by using the word primal.
Good. Good point.
And, you know, I'm thinking for myself that I have not sung collectively. I was raised in a Christian, and we went to church every Saturday, Seventh-day Adventist. And I've not sung collectively since I left the church when I was a teenager.
Wow.
That was one of the things that I think the church did really well. They understood that singing brings you together. And I'm not saying I want to go join a choir. I'm not saying I want to necessarily, but I do think – oh, I got a story. So years ago when I lived in Spokane, I would let my house be open to various people who were coming through town, and they could sleep on my couch.
Okay.
And one of the people who came through was a – how do I say this? Was an aggressive dancer, by which I mean that she loved dancing, and she kept telling me – I don't like dancing – and she kept telling me, oh, that's because you're repressed and you really need to dance, which
okay. –
no, I just don't really like dancing. Anyway – and she kept trying to convince me, let's go out somewhere and dancing. It's like, no, you can go dancing, but I mean, I have no interest. And then there was a powwow in town or out in the country, and we went to it, and there were some Indian dances, and I mean, there were some Indians dancing, and I knew that I couldn't, since I'm a white person, I couldn't wouldn't be allowed to participate. And so it was very safe for me to say, hey, you know, I would actually do these dances. There's a different. Uh-huh. And I want to step back here and say there's a book that Bill McKibben wrote in the 90s, The Age of Missing Information, where he watched everything that was available on television for 24 hours on cable. It took him a year. And he had one essay in there about dancing that really struck me. He said all the dancing on the dancing show or the dancing channel was about moving your booty. Right. And it was about dancing as sublimated sex or dancing as sex is fine, but it's only one part of life. And he was asking, where is the dance for the harvest? Where is the dance for the spring? Where is the dance for the new moon? Where is the dance for anything else in the world except for sex? And that was what I loved about the Indians that were dancing out there. They weren't dancing about sex. They were, I have no idea what it was. So anyway, I said to the person sitting next to me, I said to the person who kept trying to get me to dance, I would do these if I could, because I knew, of course, it was very safe for me to say that. And then damn if the announcer didn't say, hey, the next dance is open to white people. Come on down. So I went down, I did it, and it was called a friendship dance. It's going to cry. All it was two concentric circles going the opposite way, shuffling to music and shaking hands. That's it. And it was beautiful. And it's the same as, you know, it's the same with music, that we need music for the harvest and we need music for the,
right.
I just am so tired of, you know, Led Zeppelin, gotta give you every inch of my love.
Right.
You know, as much as the power chords work on that song.
Right.
which is the problem too.
Yes. Yes, it is. And let's not even get into the attention span.
Well, I have to go in a few minutes, but please do get it. What do you mean? I mean, I want to hear this.
Well, things in short spurts, 3 to 10 minutes, as I've learned as a musician around the world, is really nothing. It has nothing to do with anything. That life is longer. The music is longer, actually. And our capacity to actually take complex things in through music, such as Ode to Joy or these even other people who have shown longer times, is part of a meditation. And it's what you're talking about. There's so much more going on in the learning process here, even though it just seems like you might just be dancing or listening to something passively. There's a lot more going on. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And what I'm thinking, if you don't mind, is can we do another interview and use this as the starting point and just
absolutely
go on this for an hour?
I think that would be great, actually.
Because I think it's incredibly important. You know, it applies to, you know, and music, I think, is way more important than writing. But even, you know, that the person who got mad at me yesterday when I gave, you know, asked for the checklist and I gave two, you know, find a wild place you love and defend it. That was a nice little checklist, but that person also in the same conversation was getting mad at me because she was saying, I don't have time to read books. And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is the destruction of long form thinking and long form being.
Right.
And I think it's incredibly important. I mean, she was saying, can't you summarize your books for me? First off, that's really arrogant to ask me to summarize my books.
Oh yeah. I don't think that's possible, Derek.
But it's like, It was 500 pages because it needed to be 500 pages.
Right.
And it needed to have that immersion of, and I'm thinking about, you know, I don't know the music world, and I want to hear more when we talk about this again. I want to hear more about long form music. Okay. And I don't, I mean, I have been, by radio, I presume, I have been inculcated into the general 3 to 10 minute. And yeah, I know that there's symphonies, and I've certainly listened to bazillions of them. Mm-hmm. So I understand they can be longer. But I think that there is something that some way you can, I suspect there's something you're going to say that's going to pop something open for me.
Okay.
And
I mean, I have like lots of thoughts that rush through, but I, like you said, I'm more jazzed, no pun intended, to really getting more deeply into that subject, because it's highly complex, actually, on the idea of long form thinking, period.
Yeah. And, you know, I've lived on this land right here for 20 years, and I think every single day about the changes I have perceived over time and the changes I haven't perceived over time, and how there's a difference. So let's pretend that there are, and we're going to say this in a value neutral sense.
Okay.
Let's pretend that there are two people who each has the same amount of sex over a 20-year period. Okay? And not with each other. There are two, we have two parallel tracks.
They're in parallel. I get it. Okay.
And one of these people has a bunch of relationships that last a year, and some relationships that last a day, and one that lasts 3 years. And the other one has one relationship that lasts 20 years.
Okay.
And the reason we said the same amount of sex is we're getting rid of that variable. They, you know, there are things that one person would experience that the other person wouldn't. And there are things that the other person would experience that the one person wouldn't. And I'm not saying that either one is better, but there is something. There is something. There is something about a bouquet. And there is also something about a long-form relationship.
Right.
And there are lessons that can only be learned
in specific situations.
In specific situations. And I mean, we could, you know, drop off sex entirely, and we could just say, I could live in 20 different places, and I would know a bouquet of land. I would know a year's worth of the desert. I would know a year's worth of the deep south, and just that, the insects and the life and the, you know, if I lived a million times or if I lived 100 times, one of them at least, I would want to live in the deep south, just because when I've been there, the insects and the, it's, everything is so alive and full.
Right.
Plus I get kind of cold, so it'd be nice to just get too hot for a while. Anyway, so, you know, if I had lived 20 different places over those years, I would have one set of experiences, but living here, there has also been just this wondrous joy of seeing new things after 20 years and seeing patterns that I wouldn't have seen had I only been here a year. And
right.
So I'm just rambling about this, and it would be nice next time we talk, I want you to teach me some about long form music. And long form music, sorry, the reason I keep going on is because I can't help every time I think of you telling me about long form music, for whatever reason, I think about the land. And I think about the land giving us a long form of music. The land doesn't give us 3 minutes of music. It may give us a 20-second bird song, but that's just one note of the, and maybe I'm full of crap here, but I just keep thinking that as soon as you said anything about longer form music, the way my mind jumped to was the land gives us, you know, like decades long music. And am I just throwing out crap, or is this making sense to you too?
No, it actually makes a lot of sense. I'm a little surprised, but I think you're actually really onto something, actually. I think there is something to what you're talking about, and some of the studies it makes me want to look into some subjects I've already looked into musically. Wow. I mean, sometimes I even think this strikes me of what, Jack Forbes was talking about with the blues. And he put all these ideas out. As one of these interviews he did, he put all these ideas out of these studies from his Columbus and Cannibals book. And one of them, the interview asked him, well, what's your subject if you had more time to study on? He said, well, it would be music. And he said, specifically the blues, because what I find interesting about it is it's like it just appeared in the South, that natives had nothing to do with it. White people had nothing to do with it. It all just came from this one specific place. But there's so much more to it in what you're saying. And what he brought up was like there's tribes out there that do a call and response. It's very similar to blues or whatnot. And it really inspired me into like it is deeper. Music was a point of how we communicate with each other more than just a conversation in times past. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. This is really exciting to me. And I do need to go, but
okay.
I really look forward to this, and I would like to set it up. I don't mean as soon as possible, like next week, but as soon as possible as in the next few weeks, if you can do it.
Let's do that. I'll work on it. I'll look at my schedule, and we'll get a hold of our folks to make that happen.
It doesn't have to be just, I'm really excited about it, and I don't know what's going to come out of it. I mean, that's the thing with the whole long form thing too, is that the recognition that sometimes there's just, you know, you go, but it's not quite ready to be developed yet. You know, you can't.
Right.
You can't.
You can't force things.
Yeah. You can't, you can, the caterpillar goes into the cocoon, and then you can't say, hey, it's been a day. Hurry up.
Right. Takes a minute.
Yeah.
Derek, thank you so much. It is really an honor for you really helping out on this first show on this. And I just hope we continue to expand and have these wonderful conversations.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Let me know when it's going to be aired and I'll post it around.
All right. Thank you so much.
I look forward to learning a lot from you about long form music.
Well, thanks for putting me to the task. I appreciate it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye.
Peace.